It's Tuesday, February 4, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Tonight in Northern Kentucky, at the Creation Museum, a debate is going to be held, a debate that has already gained international attention. Millions of people around the world are likely to be interested in the debate that takes place here in Northern Kentucky on the issue of evolution and creation. The tickets for the event sold out in 2 minutes. Thousands of people are expected to watch by streaming video, and a total audience could be huge because the issue could not be larger. I've been asked several times by people in the media in recent days why a debate on evolution and creation is such a popular, indeed such a dramatic event. It's because, first of all, this isn't new. Back when Darwin's theories first began to gain traction in the English-speaking world, a famous series of debates was held, mostly in England, usually pitting an Anglican churchman over against one of the early modern scientists. But now what we have is Bill Nye, the science guy, as he is known, a popularizer on television of a science program mostly for children, and Ken Ham, the founder of the Creation Museum and the leader of the group known as Answers in Genesis. It's going to be a debate between a creationist and an evolutionist. Of course, there are many shades to this kind of debate that could emerge. I am planning to be there, and Lord willing, I'll be able to bring you a report tomorrow about what took place at the debate. What's already interesting, of course, is the debate about the debate. That's coming before the debate actually is held tonight. For instance, Laura Unger, writing in the Courier-Journal in Louisville, writes about the fact that there are those, especially on the side of the evolutionists, who believe that such a debate shouldn't take place. There are those on that side who are arguing that evolution is simply settled science, not merely a theory, also a set of facts. And thus it's irresponsible, they argue, for committed evolutionists to argue with those who are evolutionist deniers, those who deny the basic structure of the dominant theory of evolution. Bill Nye, the science guy, as he is known, has already picked a fight with creationists in a video that went viral last year. In that video, he suggested that parents should not teach creationism to their children. He said this, quote, "If you want to deny evolution and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we observe in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need them. We need scientifically literate voters and taxpayers for the future. We need engineers that can build stuff, solve problems," end quote. In other words, Bill Nye is following in the trajectory of some who have gone so far as to suggest that teaching creationism or denying evolution to our children is a form of child abuse, or at least of abusing them by holding them back academically and intellectually. On the other hand, there is a significant pushback from the creationist community, and you can already expect many of the arguments that will surely be made on both sides of the equation tonight in Northern Kentucky. But what might be new in this is the fact that this kind of very high-profile debate has not been held in a very long time. And one of the things that is most infuriating the evolutionist community is that the debate actually has to be held. It has to be held because, as we've discussed on this program, as was documented by the Pew Research Center, a huge number of Americans deny evolution and believe in divine creation. Furthermore, if you put all this research together, a majority of Americans believe that human beings were designed by God and not by a process of natural selection. So we have a debate that has already gained international attention, a debate worth having. It's worth having because no human being can avoid having some understanding of the issue, some basic presupposition about how the world came to be, indeed how every single one of us came to be, how human beings exist and what status we have over against the rest of creation, or shall we say, the rest of nature. And of course, the issue is basically presuppositional. That was made very clear in the article in the Courier-Journal, where I was quoted over against Ed Hensley, a Louisville member of the Kentucky Secular Society. We also appeared at opposing sides of the equation on local television at WDRB Fox 41 TV. Links to both the article and the interview will be at today's edition of The Briefing. But in his comments to the Courier-Journal, Ed Hensley, a member of the Kentucky Secular Society and also a separate atheist group, said he hopes that Bill Nye will, quote, "help expose the presuppositional nature of Answers in Genesis, that it's not science, it's religion," end quote. Well, let me suggest that I am in odd agreement with Mr. Hensley. I believe that it would serve the cause of truth if all the presuppositions of both the participants are made very clear in the midst of this debate. Because it's not just Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis that operates out of basic presuppositions. So also does Bill Nye, the science guy. Because the science guy, and in this case, the Answers in Genesis guy, are simply human beings who, like every thinking human being, operate on the basis of presuppositions. One of them operates on the presupposition of theism, the other on the presupposition of naturalism. And if you put those two things together, you'll know from the beginning where the debate will end. Next, shifting to the evolution of social media, indeed the revolution of social media in our times, we need to note that today, February the 4th, 2014, is the 10th anniversary of Facebook. The Facebook revolution began 10 years ago today. The first posting on the Facebook took place 10 years ago this morning. What we're talking about is a revolution. Social media has helped to transform the way modern people live, or shall we say, postmodern people live. This revolution has taken us beyond anything Mark Zuckerberg and the other founders of Facebook and other social media platforms could possibly have understood. Let's talk about some raw numbers. The first number, 1.2 billion. That's how many people worldwide are connected by Facebook. 1.2 billion. The trajectory of Facebook is absolutely incredible. In a matter of its first few years, it reached 250 million. But 1.2 billion? As in USA Today, Peter Seeley, who was formerly advertising and marketing director for Pepsi and also for Columbia Pictures, now an advisor to Facebook, points out, quote, today the Catholic Church has 1.2 billion members, and so does Facebook in just 10 years. In other words, by that measure, it took the Catholic Church 2,000 years, by their own sense of history, to reach 1.2 billion members. Facebook, just 10 years. Let's also talk some numbers when it comes to money. Facebook is now valuated at $138 billion. It will soon become the fastest company in world history to reach a valuation of $150 billion. For example, it took IBM 83 years to reach a valuation of $150 billion. Even Oracle, 14 years. Intel, 27 years. Microsoft, 11 years. And you're looking at Facebook reaching that in less than 1.5 years ahead. In other words, the fastest company in world history to reach $150 billion of value. Also, another comparison, Apple took 27 years, almost three times as long. Within its first year, 1 million people used Facebook. Just 4 years later, 250 million people. Now, 1.2 billion people. There are so many interesting things to think about at this 10-year anniversary. One of them is the companies that didn't survive. 10 years ago, people were talking about MySpace. It was launched before Facebook. It was launched in 2003. It was sold 2 years later to Rupert Murdoch's News Group for $580 million. In 2011, that's about 3 years ago, it was sold for a mere $35 million, and almost no one talks about it now. But even as Facebook is a big survivor, we'll talk more about that in just a moment, it is surrounded by many other new platforms in social media. A great deal of the energy in social media has transferred from Facebook to Twitter, and also to other platforms, including things like Snapchat and Instagram. But then again, Facebook bought Instagram, and what we're looking at here is a huge platform of social media onto which well over a billion human beings are now connected, and they're connected to each other, redefining human relationships, redefining human intimacy. The Pew Research Center, you'll not be surprised, is out with some very interesting statistics on Facebook on its 10th anniversary. It's used by 57% of all adults in the United States. That's 57%. It's used by 73% of all those in the United States ages 12 to 17. But growth on Facebook is actually taking place at a pretty rapid pace among adults. 64% of Facebook users visit the site on a daily basis. That's adult use. And that's up from 51% of adult users who were daily users just in 2010. Among teens, the total number of users remains high. The Pew Research Center says by its surveys, they're not abandoning Facebook. They're just also going elsewhere. Here is one statistic on Facebook that really caught my attention. Of those who do not use Facebook, over half of them, 52%, have someone in their household who is using Facebook, largely for them. That's also a very interesting phenomenon. So when you're looking at 1.2 billion people connected, there are an awful lot of people who are very nearly connected because they're very closely related to someone who is connected. Along the way towards becoming so much a part of our lives and of American and international culture, Facebook has made some changes. Its most remarkable change is the change towards being a mobile platform. It now considers itself a mobile-first corporation. In other words, they expect that most of the people who use Facebook will use it on a mobile platform, not on a PC. When the company began, virtually everyone accessed Facebook by means of the personal computer. Now it's a smartphone. Who knows what will come next? One aspect of the so-called Facebook effect is the fact that it had a significant depressional effect on email. Email started to fall off in terms of content communication email when Facebook began to surge. Email, in terms of its massive use now, is largely an advertising platform. The kind of communication that goes on the Facebook platform changed it from an interaction that went back and forth in private to a more public conversation in which information is now shared in real time with people other than the limited number of persons who might receive an email. And of course, it's simply posted, it's there. The idea that one has to make an immediate response, as was at least implicated by email, is very much less a factor on Facebook. But the huge issue when it comes to Facebook, of course, is the way that personal identity, personal relationships, and so much personal communication was shifted to an online dimension and away from real-time, face-to-face conversation. From a Christian worldview perspective, this has to be hugely important. The Bible points to the importance of human relationships, to the vitality of face-to-face communication, of the nurturing of those relationships in terms of the intimacy of the family and of marriage, and of course of the importance of the social community, of the neighborhood, and of the family, the village. But what we're looking at now is a very different way than human beings experience community, experience communication, and experience each other. Indeed, how they experience their lives. There is great gain in this, and we need to recognize that gain. It has become possible now to be intimately connected to persons whom we will never see, who are distant from us in terms of space and time, such that in any previous age to the social media revolution, we would have lost track with them. There would be virtually no way to keep in contact with them, much less to know what's going on in their everyday lives and in their own network of relationships, to watch their children grow up, to watch significant events take place, to share the events and highs and lows of their lives. And furthermore, there is also a tremendous addition to the amount of textured information that we actually can share and know about one another. It turns out that even though on many of these platforms, the very first impression was everyone was saying what they had for breakfast, eventually it actually got to a more natural way of communicating in which we know what someone does on vacation, thus we know what interests them. We see whom they're with. We come to understand what they value. We can know the great moments of their lives like weddings, and we can share in the saddest moment of their lives, like funerals. We can communicate with one another in a way we never could before. There has been a transformation in the way that people have been formerly socially isolated, and many of them cut off from the other kinds of intimacy and relationships that others can enjoy simply because they did not have access to them, either because of where they live or the conditions in which they live. Much of that has now been overcome. That's a good thing. The negative aspects are also huge. As a matter of fact, they are massive. For one thing, there's been a transformation in personal identity. There's been a complication in that identity because many people have an online persona that is actually not their real-life persona. That's a problem. But it's also a problem when our real-life persona is actually the same as that online persona. What do I mean? What I mean by that is that many people are actually putting out information that should not be shared. And that's especially true for young people who tend to be extraordinarily dominant in terms of the use of social media. And there are many vulnerabilities to this. But one of the greatest vulnerabilities to all of us, regardless of age, but the young here are certainly more vulnerable, is not what is gained, but what is lost. What is lost is the investment in face-to-face conversation. What is lost is the social interaction, even within the context of a family and a household, where far too much is now shared in many families, between parents and children, between spouses, and between intimates in the family extended relationship, by means of social media. We now have parents texting their children while the child's in the bedroom. We now have people posting on Facebook what they should be talking about face-to-face. And of course, we're not even getting to the fact that there is so much going on in terms of the consumerism and the marketing and the advertising, the pornography, and so many other things that also happen in terms of the social media platform. Many of those things are simply extensions of what have taken place in terms of every technological revolution. But this one tends to be more dangerous, more subtle, and at sometimes more promising because of the way it's redefining actually how we relate to one another. And if Christians understand anything, it is that being made in the image of God, we were made to relate to our Creator and given the gift and the need, indeed the responsibility, to communicate with one another, to have relationships with other of these creatures made in God's image. It would be an exaggeration. And furthermore, an imbalanced understanding to say that social media has subtracted net from all of that. There's been a great deal of gain, but it has subtracted in far too many ways where it matters most. And for that, we will face a judgment. In any event, a 10-year anniversary of a technology of this effect, this magnitude, and this influence is worthy of our consideration. There's much more to be said about it. But at least when we think about this 10-year anniversary, let's consider what it means that we're living and relating and communicating in fundamentally different ways than our grandparents could ever have believed. And to be honest, that many of us even now recognize. Finally, the Gallup organization is out with a very interesting study, and that has to do with the fact that there is a relative religiosity reflected in the 50 states of the United States of America. If this is news, the news is it's pretty much what you thought. For instance, the most religious states in the Union, according to Gallup, by their measure of religiosity, the percentage of persons who consider themselves, and Gallup considers, very religious, at the top of the list, Mississippi, 61%, very religious. Then Utah, Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Arkansas, North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. Now, if you were looking at that list, of that top 10 list, the only state that is not in the South or the Mid-South, and the only state that is not predominantly Christian, and that evangelical Christian, is the state of Utah, overwhelmingly Mormon, and of course, in the Western Mountain States. But when you look at the other nine states, they're all pretty much where you expected them to be, loosely arranged along what has been called for many years now the Bible Belt. In other words, that Bible Belt is still there. At the other end of the extreme, the least religious states, based upon the percentage of very religious people, at the top of that list is Vermont, only 22% very religious. And then rounding out the bottom 10 in terms of religiosity, you add the states of New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, Oregon, Nevada, Washington, Connecticut, Hawaii, and the District of Columbia. You'll notice something else. Virtually all of these states are on the two coasts. The two most secular regions in the United States are now the area of New England, and then add to that the Pacific Northwest. After that, the Middle Atlantic states. The states that are outliers in terms of this list, thus, are Nevada, which also tends to be, in this case, allied with the western coastal states, and Hawaii, also basically allied with those western coastal states, the Pacific Coast. So what we're looking at here is a coastal secularity and a heartland religiosity. As I told you, there's no news here. But there is, in a sense. It's news that this is still considered a very interesting and live question by an organization such as the Gallup organization that's been measuring this kind of thing for decades now. It's also interesting because even though the secularization of this country is moving forward at a fast pace and cultural Christianity is itself fast disappearing, it's not disappearing evenly everywhere all the same. And secularization is not proceeding everywhere at the same pace. But as the Gallup organization itself stated, and I quote, these regional variations are quite stable and look generally the same now as they did 6 years ago. They reflect basic state cultures that are highly persistent, even as the states experience demographic changes through births, deaths, and migration, end quote. At several points on this program, we come back to the fact that geography matters, that it matters where you live, not only in the world, in the global scene, but also within the United States of America. There are many who live in very highly secularized regions where secularization is proceeding at a very fast pace. That's especially true on the two coasts. By the way, as we discussed in other research, it appears now that New England is even more secular in that sense than the Pacific Northwest. The difference is that the Pacific Northwest never had anything like the two Great Awakenings that greatly shaped America, especially in the American Northeast. There are other Americans who are living in areas of the country where secularization is not quite so noticeable. But even there, as the data make very clear, secularization is happening. It's just happening a bit slower, with a bit more subtlety. But it's happening. And when you look at variation over time, it's clear that even where you find the Bible Belt, that Bible Belt is slipping. It's just slipping, generally, rather slowly. Remember that every Saturday now is released Ask Anything Weekend Edition. To call with your question, give us a call at 877-505-2058. That's our new program, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. You can go to the website and find last Saturday's edition, and stay tuned for what's coming this Saturday. We'd love to have your question in your voice. The number, 877-505-2058. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.